with us some pre-Pesach Torah, and at this time it's an honor to call upon Rabbi Yonason Shiffel. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to come closer. Is that all right? Part of the family. So thank you, Rabbi Brand. It's an honor to be here. And thank you, friends. I don't know, there are not too many places in the world where at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning people come to learn for 2 hours. So you are exceptional human beings. It's just 3 weeks from now that we're going to sit at the Seder and we're going to say Chayav Adam Liros Es Atzmo Ki'iluhu Yatzam Mitzrayim, that everyone's obligated to see themselves as if they've come out of Egypt. And I don't know about you, but for me that's something quite difficult to relate to. In fact, what year did we come out of Egypt? No friends. 2448. What's your name?
Matt.
Matt's telling us one of the two most important dates in all of Jewish history that every Jew has to know. The one is very simple. When did Avraham Avinu arrive on the scene? 1948, and 500 years later, it's very easy to remember, the State of Israel was founded in 1948. On the Jewish calendar, 1948, Avraham Avinu arrives. And 500 years later, in 2448, we leave Egypt. So that means that we are now 3,327 years post the Exodus from Egypt. I don't know what the trend here is in Chicago, where people are for Yom Tov. Hopefully you're home. I live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. We actually close our shul for Yom Tov. It's the most ridiculous thing. But there's no one there. Pesach, mass exodus. First day is Sukkot. Even if I tried to have a minyan, I wouldn't have one. Gone. But hopefully you're at home. And we sit in our homes, whether we're in Skokie or wherever we are, find ourselves in the world, and we're supposed to re-experience something that took place 3,327 years ago. And I think for most of us, it's quite a difficult task. Most of us, I think, struggle with understanding and relating to an event that took place 200 years ago. Never mind 3,327 years ago. So I'll tell you a fascinating story. It might be apocryphal. I've heard it from some special people over the years. But even if it's apocryphal, it makes a lot of sense. Supposedly, the story goes that a young girl once approached the Chafetz Chaim Zichron Livracha and asked him this question. How in Radin are you supposed to re-experience Pesach that took place then some 3,000 years ago? And the Chofetz Chaim looked at this little girl and he said to her, how many generations are going to be at your Seder table? So for those of us who are incredibly fortunate, there are going to be 3 generations in our Seder table. Grandparents, parents, and children. Some people are very, very fortunate that they have great-grandparents or great-grandchildren at the table. But I would say hopefully the average family has 3 generations represented at their Seder experience. And that's what this little girl answered the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim then remarked, and he said to her, but there aren't just 3 generations at your Seder table. Because your grandparents also were at their parents' and their grandparents' Seder table. So that means, said the Chofetz Chaim, that the average Seder table, the Jewish people, represents 5 generations of the Jewish national experience. In those days, the Chofetz Chaim went with the social anthropological reality of the time, and that was that an average generation was 20 years. So that means that the average Seder table, 5 generations times 20, represents 100 years of the Jewish national experience. Said the Chofetz Chaim to this little girl, if you look at 3,300 years, I agree with you, it's something very difficult to relate to. But if you think to yourself that in the history of the Jewish people, there have only been 33 unique Seder tables, that might be something that even you at your young age can relate to. And every year when I sit down at the Seder table, my kids know, it's one of the stories that get told every single year, the same story. I heard this story originally from my Rosh Hashiva Zichron Livracha, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg in Baltimore. And it just made something that seemed so distant, all of a sudden something that one can relate to. So we're sitting down at the 33rd unique Seder table in Jewish history. And the Seder is the night of transmission. It's a night when we bring out our bobbers, candles, sticks, and our safta's recipes, and we connect the past and the present. But we focus on the present. You know, in our prayers, we have this famous statement that we say, Hashem Melech, Hashem Malach, Hashem Yimlech Le'olam Vaed. God is our King, God was our King, and God will be our King for now and forever. Well, the reality is, friends, that is not a verse anywhere found in all of our holy books. It's a verse that appears in the Siddur, the prayer book, a verse that appears in the Machzor. We all scream it out at the end of Yom Kippur. But it's really the compilation of three different statements. And the simple but fundamental question that one has to ask upon this statement or exclamation that we scream out, Hashem Melech, Hashem Malach, Hashem Yimlech, L'Olam Vaed, God is our King, God was our King, and God will be our King, is that it's chronologically completely out of order. It should read, Hashem Malach, Hashem Melech, Hashem Yimlech, L'Olam Vaed. So why is it out of order? So I would suggest that I think the reason it's out of order is because everything's dependent upon whether you have a relationship with God as your King in the present tense. If you can declare that, then yes, you are approving and vindicating your past, that Hashem Malach, that I come from a family that has a past, that God was our King, and I'm ensuring that Hashem Yimloch, that God will be our King. But everything's dependent on your relationship with God in the present tense. Trust me, I have the great privilege to spend most of my days learning Torah with both at YU and in my congregation, learning Torah with young men or young families, Jews of all generations, who have not had the opportunity to be committed to their, or to learn Torah, to be committed to a Torah lifestyle. And whenever I go into someone's house, one of the first things that they all come to show me is a beautiful black and white picture that they have from their grandparents sitting or standing outside of their home in the shtetl that somehow made it to North America. And everyone's very proud of their past. And that's an important step. You have to know what your past is in order to plan your future. But those same people that are showing me those pictures, if I ask them the same question, if we took a picture today, and two or three generations from now, your grandchildren will look at those pictures, are they going to have the same Jewish pride that you have of your great-grandparents in the shtetl? You know, there's an interesting comment, and that is that we have a concept in Jewish law called hiddur mitzvah, the beautification of a mitzvah. And when it comes to beautifying a mitzvah, it means putting more effort into the mitzvah. It means spending more money on the mitzvah, etc., etc. But there's an interesting reality, and that is the Jews seem to have this fascination with silver. And it's even brought down the code of Jewish law. that when it comes to Hanukkah, and you want to have the most beautiful menorah, well, the tradition is to have a silver menorah. When it comes to Friday night candlesticks, the most beautiful way to have the mitzvah is to have silver candlesticks. Some people even go so far that they have silver on their talis and atara. Some people have a silver esrog box. Probably the most commonly found silver object in a Jewish home is a kiddush cup, challah knives. I mean, it's almost like we're infatuated with silver. You can go into some homes and you have a whole wall. What's that all about? And I'll ask you a better question. If we clearly understand that we have to beautify our mitzvahs, why silver? Why not gold? Trust me, if the tradition was to have gold, then we would put a few more dollars on the credit card. I don't know what the Chicago silver establishments are called, but in New York they're called Grand Sterling. It would be called Grand Gold. And we'd all have a gold kiddush cup and gold candelabra. Why silver? Why not gold? There's a early commentary called the Akedas Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Arma, and he gives us such a simple but profound insight. And he says, where do we find gold in the Torah? No, let me hear. Sorry, what's your name? Sorry? Rana? Rana says, last week, the Eagle Azav, the golden calf, where else? Think back just to yesterday. Yes, ma'am? What is your name?
Vivian.
Vivian says, in the Mishkan. Where in the Mishkan? Okay, you've got let's even just start with it, with the ark, the golden altar, etc., etc. Where else? Let's leave it there. The temple was made out of gold. Anyone who's been to Jerusalem lately, last, I would say, 5 or 10 years, I don't remember how long it's up, as you come down those very steep steps to the Kotel, you see in that glass bubble how the Temple Institute has recreated the menorah of old out of solid gold. So why do we have gold? Why do we have silver? So says the Akedas Yitzchak, there's a fundamental difference between silver and gold. And he didn't mean the share price. The fundamental difference is that silver tarnishes and gold doesn't tarnish. The ark in the Holy Temple could never tarnish. When the Jews wished to replace, however you want to interpret the story, either Moshe or God with the golden calf, they also wanted to replace it with something that would not tarnish. Silver tarnishes. And part of the Hiddur mitzvah, part of beautifying the mitzvah, is not just going to Grand Sterling. I don't work this, I'm not trying to give them a commercial endorsement here. Not just going to Grand Sterling to purchase those silver leichter, those silver candlesticks. But the Hiddur mitzvah is consistently polishing those candlesticks. And let me tell you, friends, it's very often that I'll go into that same home, they will run to show me that picture of the Alter Rebbe and Zayda, and then I start scanning the house to see where's some ritual object. And very often, way up on a shelf, as bookends, or just as a display piece, I'll see a menorah, or I'll see candlesticks. And those objects are black, as if you thought they're made out of wrought iron. And I say, bring it down. And you look carefully and you see that in fact, it's actually originally silver. But no one has been polishing it. week after week, year after year. And hiddur mitzvah, beautifying the mitzvah, requires us not only to purchase, but to consistently polish. And that's what we're going to do here today. Let's look at this statement that we're going to make at the Seder. Chayav Adam Liras Esatzmo. And see how we can polish it. See how we can prepare ourselves more for the Seder. Now the Seder literally means order. We know it has 15 steps, corresponding with the 15 steps in the Holy Temple, the 15 paragraphs of Shir HaMalos, the Song of the Steps. And it's there to take us from one place to another. It's a night of transition. A night of transitioning from slavery into freedom. And there's a famous question asked, and that is that we know normally when we perform a mitzvah, we make a bracha prior to the performance of a mitzvah. And the true mitzvah of the night, besides all of the others, is to tell the story. And the reason we bring our grandparents into it is because we want to make the story real, and so we tell the story of our own family's history as we move off the pages of the Haggadah as well. And we follow these 15 steps. Why is there no bracha prior to telling the story of the Seder? It's a mitzvah. V'higada telavincha, tell this to your children. Why don't we make a bracha? Says the great Chasam Sofer, we do make a bracha. But you know when we make that bracha? Only at the end of Maggid. At the end of telling the entire story, just before we're about to wash and eat and make the sandwich and everything else, we make the bracha Asher Ga'alis Avoseinu, who has redeemed our ancestors and redeemed us. Says the Chasam Sofer, that is the bracha on telling the story of the Seder. So now you have a fundamental question. Why is the bracha at the end of Maggid? Says the Chasam Sofer, because it's like a process of conversion. When a person decides that they want to convert and become part of the Jewish people, when do they make the bracha, accepting upon themselves the yoke of God's commandments? Only at the end of the process. So when you've got there, and you finish telling the first major part of the story, then says the Chasam Sofer that you can make the blessing. In fact, I could tell you that my wife's great-great-grandfather, one of the great rebbes of Rishon, he had a tradition that at the beginning of the Seder, they would sing songs or nigunim that were almost like dirges. And when it came time for that second bracha of Gal Yisrael to represent that they had gone through and transitioned, they would sing the most levadika, lively, incredibly spirited songs you could imagine. I know that many people of Sephardic background, that when it comes time for that bracha of Gal Yisrael, that the same way they picked up their matzahs or their pillowcases and put them over their shoulders and walked around the table at the very beginning when they said, Avodim Ayinu L'Farim Mitzrayim, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and they said, Krechs, and oy, as they walked around. At that point, they picked them up again, and they run around, and they dance. And some families even put a bucket. I once had the privilege to spend Pesach in the home of Rabbi Robert Ishai Olav HaShalom, a Sephardi Rav in Atlanta. My late father, Olav HaShalom, came to America for a sabbatical from South Africa, and we were in Atlanta for a year, and the Sephardi Rav invited us. I was about 7 years old, but I remember to this day, and I actually incorporated into my own Seder, and Rabbi Ishai Seder, when it came to that point, not only was it Leibedik, but he actually put out even a bucket of water that you had to jump over as you were going around the table, as if you had crossed the Red Sea yourself. That's what we're meant to do. Now let's look for a second at these 15 steps. And you tell me if there's really an order. So Kaddish is making Kiddush. reminds us we have four cups of wine to remember the four steps, the four languages of Geula, of redemption. Kadesh, we drink our first cup of wine. By the way, there's a tradition that at the Seder men wear a kittel. Why? A kittel, that same white garment without pockets that a man wears at his wedding, that he wears on Yom Kippur, and some wear even the same kittel after 120 on their final journey. Why is there a tradition to wear a kittel at the Seder? Anyone have an idea? Why is the tradition to wear a kittel at the Seder? Okay, purity. So maybe just wear a white shirt to represent purity. Why specifically a kittel? What's your name?
Ruth.
You agree with me? You could just wear white. Why specifically a kittel? Yes?
Like a rebirth.
Vivian, right? Yes?
Like a rebirth.
Like, what do you mean by that?
So now Hashem redeemed us from Egypt, and we're going to be his
out of it's like a new stage on the life's journey. I know every chassan that I teach comes to me and says, Rabbi, what's the connection between wearing a kittel at under the chuppah and then also in your coffin? So I always use as a famous line from Lord Jacobowitz, the former chief rabbi of England. He used to say, you're only half until you're married and then you're totally finished. But the question's better than my answer. Vivian saying an aspect of rebirth. Anyone else? So I once asked the square rabbi, what's the pshat? What is it? And he looked at me and he said, a kittel is a garment of truth. It has no pockets. It's what you wear at the most pivotal moments of your life. And you put on that garment of truth to indicate to your children and to those around you and to yourself that tonight's a night of truth. When we are going to share our legacy with the future generations. So let's look for a second at the order of the Seder and try to understand the Seder. So Kadesh is we drink the first cup. We're already starting to drink the wine. We're relaxing. We're leaning to the left and we're on our way out of Egypt. Urchatz, we wash our hands without a blessing. Why? To remember temple times when before eating a food that came into contact with one of these seven holy liquids, in temple times we would wash our hands. So we now just went from leaving Egypt. We've catapulted about 1,000 years ahead. Let's call it 500 years ahead. And we're already in the first temple. Then, Karpas. Why do we dip? Why do we eat the... some people eat parsley, some people eat potatoes, some people eat celery, some people dill, scallions, whatever your custom is. Why do we eat karpas? Sorry? Remind me your first name, sorry?
Ruth.
Ruth, very good. We're back to Yosef. We're reminding ourselves of how we got to Egypt in the first place. When they dipped his coats of many colors, Rashi says, karpas, fine silk that was striped into the blood. Now, after that, we go to Yachatz. Why do we break the matzah? Why do we break the matzah, friends? Come on, you all know this. Sorry? Okay, part of it's going away for the Afikoman, where we break the matzah and the subsequent blessings are going to be made with a broken matzah because we were poor people. Poor people eat shards of bread to represent poverty. We're back in Egypt. After that, we've got Maggid. We tell the story. After that, Rachsa, we wash our hands. Well, then we drink the second cup of wine and we made the blessing as if we've completed the conversion process. Then Rachsa, then Motzi Matzah, then we eat the matzah that we ate while we're on our way out of Egypt. Now we're completely out. We've already drank two cups of wines, but now we're back in the maror. Now we're eating the bitter herbs, and we're re-experiencing Egypt. Now Korech is back. Charoses takes us back to the mortar and the Egypt experience. Then Shulchan Aruch. Then you sit down like a king, and you eat and bring out the best Epicurean delights, and it's a gastronomic feast like no tomorrow. After which, Safun, the Afikomen. The Afikomen is in place of the Karban Pesach. When do we eat the Karban Pesach? On the eve of leaving Egypt. Then Barach, you bench. Then Hallel, you sing songs of praise. And then Nirtza, Lashon Haba Yerushalayim. Is this in order? I would say it's completely out of order. It's an order that's completely out of order. You know, one of my young students said to me last week, I was talking to him, I said, look at the difference between your parents' generation and your generation. I said, when we all look at our parents, and I look at you, you are examples of consistent people. The young generation, 20 and under, today, one of my students says, Rabbi, I was complaining to them, I said, your parents' generation, as the generations unfold, they become less and less consistent. So one of my students raises his hand, he says, Rabbi, he says, we're also consistent. I said, what do you mean? He says, we're consistently inconsistent. But the bottom line is there order here? Absolutely no order. There is order, the 15 steps you have to follow. But they seem completely out of order. If I had to rearrange them, Ruth, you seem to be writing down there. How would you rearrange them?
I was looking to see if there was any
atbash
in it.
Okay. Okay, you don't have to even get into atbash. Let's just do it simply.
In theory, you keep all of the Mitzrayim together.
Okay, so I would start with Karpas, because that's how we got there in the first place. Afterwards, Maror. Maror and Yachatz. Afterwards, what would be next?
Maybe Korech.
Korech. Okay, Tzafun. Tzafun, first the Korban Pesach, then Korech. Then Magid, probably, you tell the story. Then you would eat the meal. Then, with the meal, you drink all four cups of wine very quickly. And then the last thing I would do is Rachta, is the Urchat, to represent the temple, and Lashon Haba Yerushalayim. So on one hand, it is an order, 15 steps. But it's completely out of order. In fact, it's so out of order that it mimics the actual exodus from Egypt. The Torah tells us, when did we come out of Egypt? B'chatzot ha'layla, in the middle of the night. Now the famous Maharal of Prague asks, as do many of the classic commentaries, at which point on the clock is the middle of the night? Is there a point on the clock that's the middle of the night? If you have a pie, and you divide, let's say, a classic night, is 12 hours, from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., so let's look at it in terms of a pie. If you take a pie and you divide a pie in half, and now they're two halves of the night. So which moment is actually on the clock? Is midnight. The middle of the night. What's your name?
Ethel.
Which point on the clock is actually not midnight, what we call midnight, but the middle of the night? So the answer is there is no point on the number line. Because if you divide the night into two halves, each part of that pie is either going to be in one half or the other half. So that means the moment of the middle of the night was actually a moment outside of time. And part of our experience at the Seder, friends, is to show our children and ourselves that although there's an order that seemingly seems completely out of order, totally out of order, Because just once we've drank the second cup and we're in the blank. You know that famous story between, they tell a famous story, one of the most famous YU legends. It's Rabbi Belkin, Olav HaShalom, the great founder, and the great founders of Yeshiva University. So they tell a story that once the Cardinal of New York wanted to meet Rabbi Belkin to have a discussion with him about issues that concerned both of them. And they had this meeting, and how many people have heard this story? And at the end of the meeting, the Cardinal turns to Rabbi Belkin, Olav HaShalom, and he says to him, he says, you know, Rabbi, he says, I came here knowing that we come from Judeo-Christian traditions, and there's certain things we share, and certain things that we don't share. But after spending many hours with you, I see that in fact we share much more than I ever dreamt. Rabbi Belkin looks at him and he says, Cardinal, he says, I knew what we shared before you came. But after spending a few hours with you, I see that we are fundamentally different. More than I ever could have imagined. So the Cardinal looks at Rabbi Belkin and he says to him, he says, can you explain? So the story goes that the Rabbi Belkin began his explanation by saying, Cardinal, he said, you see, the first thing that I came to realize about half an hour into our discussions is that you wear a red yarmulke and your institutions are in the black. And I wear a black yarmulke and my institution's in the red. But here we are, we're in the black already. We've drunk the second cup of wine, Gal Yisrael, we've finished the conversion process. And we're there. We're there. And all of a sudden, now Maror, we're back into the bitterness of Egypt. And Charoises, we're back with the mortar and we're rebuilding those Arei Miskenais Lepara, those storage cities. Doesn't make sense. My friends, that's the secret of the Seder. To sit and to explain to your children and to ourselves that God has a plan and there's an order. Even when sometimes things go awry. But we're here to celebrate the legacy of that order and to celebrate the fact that Hashem Melech, Hashem is our King. And we are His people. Now, there are many things that we can do at the Seder that will help us achieve this freedom. Some people looking from a historical context, the one thing I will tell you, and I think this is my most important part of the entire shiur, and that is, I think the greatest lesson that I've learned from being a parent myself and being a communal rabbi, is that if you really want your family to experience freedom, 3 Friday nights from now, the most important preparation that you can do for the Seder is to make sure that you sleep on Friday afternoon. Because if you go to the Seder tired, you're going to accomplish nothing. The most important thing, it's better to have, if you haven't had time to make all those desserts, all those dishes, it's better to take off 2 hours and put the whole family to sleep. And I know as my kids became teenagers, Dad, are you sure? If you don't sleep, you're not coming. Sometimes I had to bribe them over the years. But when you sleep and you come to the Seder with a clear mind and you're relaxed, and especially this year, there's going to be a tremendous Yetzirah because the Seder is on Friday night. And that same Yetzirah that dances every Friday in every Jewish home is going to be on steroids. And he tries to get people anxious as Shabbos comes in. The most important thing you can prepare to experience freedom is to sleep. Because when you're cranky, all of the holy books say that the greatest impediment towards refining our character, which is really the purpose of the entire Torah, is lack of sleep. But when a person doesn't have enough sleep, they don't behave as they're meant to. So sleep. But I want to discuss with you in the few minutes we have left. I've always been bothered by these four Shabbosim. These four special Shabbatot that precede Pesach. We're already into three of them by now. We have Shabbos Shkolim, Shabbos Zocher, Shabbos Parah, this four Shabbos. And coming up this coming week, Shabbos HaChodesh. And we all know what the simple pshat, literal reason is for each one of them. Shabbos Shkolim is because in temple times there was an annual appeal where everyone had to give towards the maintenance of the Holy Temple and the communal sacrifices, and your donation had to be in by Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And so just prior to Rosh Chodesh Adar, around the time of Rosh Chodesh Adar, they would announce that people had to bring in their shkolim. And so today we don't have an actual collection, but rather we read, in each one of these, we read the Torah portion instead of the actual act. Parsha Zohar is clearly connected to Purim. We have a mitzvah from the Torah to remember Amalek, to decimate Amalek, and annually we remember just prior to Purim, which represents part of the legacy of Amalek of Haman, we remember our mitzvah to obliterate Amalek. Parshas Parah, this past week, I always, on my way home, in South Africa when we had a shul, I used to actually get Red Bull to sponsor the Kiddush on Parshas Parah, to make Parshas Parah come alive to the kids, Lavdil. But Parshas Parah is about purity and impurity. And if a person is in a state of spiritual impurity, in order to bring the Paschal sacrifice, one needed to use the ashes of the Parah Aduma. And finally, is Parshas HaChodesh this week, going back to that first mitzvah given to the Jewish people of establishing a calendar, HaChodesh HaZalachem. By the way, when we talk about the calendar, friends, it's an amazing thing. I don't know if you ever thought about it. What's a day in nature? What's a day in nature? What happens during the course of a day in nature? Come, let's go back to fifth grade science. Earth science. Come on, everyone knows.
Earth turns around.
What's your name?
Daniel
says the earth revolves on its axis. What happens in a month in nature, Daniel?
The
moon revolves around the earth. What happens in a year in nature?
The
earth revolves around the sun. What happens in a week in nature?
Shabbos.
What happens in nature? A week. Ethel, what specifically happens? Seven revolutions, seven times the earth spins on its axis, nothing unique. So the answer is, there's nothing unique. Because a week comes from the Torah. There's nothing, everything else, something happens in nature. A week comes from the Torah. I'll meet these people and they'll say to me, "Hey, Rabbi, listen, just before we learn, I want you to know I'm an atheist, I'm agnostic." So then I look at them and I say, "What are you doing this Saturday or Sunday?" So I say, "Rabbi, you mean this weekend?" I said, no, you can't call it a weekend. You have to call it Saturday and Sunday." So they look at me, why I ask them these questions? So I say, if you say week, and you validate that the concept of a week exists, then you're validating a creation process. Because the concept of a week comes from the Torah. 6 days of creation. All of mankind, yes, different people have different times when the week begins and when the week ends. But a week comes from Bereshis, like Daniel said. That's where it comes from. Chodesh HaZalachem, God gave us, Hashem created the weeks, gives us the ability to create the months and the calendar. But maybe there's another way of looking at these four things. You see, as I'm sure we all know, that other people from a Kabbalistic or Hasidic perspective look at the Exodus from Egypt and they say, well, you can't really relate to something that took place so many years ago. So let's rather look at it from the perspective of the Egypt of our own lives. Because the Hebrew word Mitzrayim and Mitzarim limitations mean the same thing. So maybe one can look at these four special Shabbosim as addressing four different types of slavery the modern man encounters. Shabbos Shkolim represents slavery to money. It's not that it says on the dollar in God we trust, but rather that people believe in money. And they think that money is the most important thing on earth. And people do crazy things for money. You know, my father-in-law, Lev HaShalom, used to say, where there's a will, there are relatives. But the bottom line is people do crazy things for money. And they'll destroy families. And Shabbos Shkolim is a time when we have to look at ourselves and say, are we enslaved to money? Parsha Zohar, Amalek today doesn't represent a physical enemy. He's a spiritual enemy. And one of the spiritual ways he manifests himself is the holy books tell us that Amalek has the same gematria, the same numerical value as the Hebrew word Safek, which means doubt. Because Amalek came, the Jewish people were untouchable, and all of a sudden he attacked from behind, and now all of a sudden everyone wasn't so sure. Are they really untouchable? Is their God really impenetrable? Amalek represents intellectual slavery. People that get stuck in this world of what's called analysis paralysis. Some people, it manifests itself in something called commitment-itis. That they struggle to make commitments. Or they're just constantly busy analyzing and overanalyzing. They never get anything done. And Amalek represents being in that cycle of inability to make decisions. And it's not for naught, friends, that our rabbis say, Ein simcha ka'ataras ha'sveik, is that there's no joy in life better than the resolution of doubt. Because when a person finds themselves in the shackles of doubt, and they're not sure, should I invest, shouldn't I invest, should I propose, shouldn't I propose, this, that, everything else, back and forth, that's a manifestation of Amalek. Then there's Parashas Parah. I don't even have to say too much. Parashas Parah represents a world of purity and impurity. And today, in the crazy world that we're living in, with all of its tremendous opportunities, we all know of the challenges of impurity that exist. And to make sure that one is not a slave to the world of impurity. And then finally, there's Parashas HaChodesh, which represents time. I think you'll all agree with me that if you want something to get accomplished, ask a busy person to accomplish it. Are we slaves to time or slot time? Are we in control of time? Very often you will find. I send emails. We live in this world where you have to respond straight away. I send an email to a man or woman who's running some huge corporation. And 1, 2, 3, I'll get a response. And then I'll send one to a person who doesn't have that much going on in their life. And it can take 3, 4 days for them to respond. Do we control our time? Or does time control us? And so I think each of these holidays, each of these special Shabbosim represents a different type of slavery. Slavery to money, slavery to intellectual, slavery to doubt, slavery to impurity, and slavery to time. And each one of them provides us with an opportunity, and an auspicious moment to overcome and to look at our own lives and look at our own limitations and to overcome whatever that type of slavery is. So that when the time comes that we can sit at the Seder table, we in fact can celebrate what it means to be free. So we can sit in Skokie or we can sit in Evanston or wherever you are for the Seder. And you can look at your life and say, no, those were slaveries of the past. I'm now in a whole different place. I'll end with one incredible story. There's a, as Rabbi Brand said, I had the great fortune to, my wife and I together, to start a community in Cape Town in South Africa. I was born there, went back to my birthplace to try and make a difference. In Cape Town, there are many huge shuls. And there are quite a few South Africans here in Chicago. So I'm sure you know that South African Jewry is a unique Jewish community because the vast majority of South African Jews come from one Pale of Settlement in Lithuania. And there's no conservative shuls in South Africa, conservative temples. There are a few reform ones, but they're almost non-existent. The vast majority of South African Jews are what we call non-observant Orthodox Jews. I think it used to be more. Non-observant Orthodox Jews. When they go to shul, they go to an Orthodox shul. But filled with traditions, but not necessarily doing everything all the time. In fact, the late chief rabbi of South Africa, Louis Rabinowitz, once said, someone asked him, he said, what's the difference in South Africa between the Orthodox shuls and the Reform shuls? So he said, one block. So people look at him like he's crazy. So he says, in the Reform shuls, they park in the parking lot. In the Orthodox shuls, they park one block away. But that one block represents, and that's where I grew up. Friday night, we had to be home for Kiddush. Afterwards, we could go out. Saturday morning, unless we had a bar mitzvah, we went to the beach. And my father, Olav HaShalom, was not happy when the rabbi moved three blocks from us. Because we had to make sure that our going to beach schedule did not coincide with the rabbi's schedule walking to shul. And if we would ever come near the rabbi, my father would say, duck. And once the rabbi actually gave a drasha on Kol Nidre night, and everyone is in shul, and he said, you know, people come to me and they argue, and they say, Rabbi, it was so much easier to believe in biblical times. He says, there were all these open miracles. He says, today, no open miracles. He says, I don't know, congregants. The Rebbetzin and I see open miracles every single Shabbos. So everyone's looking at him. Rabbi, what do you mean? He says, when we walk to shul and we walk back from shul, there's so many cars going without any drivers. Because everyone's down. So in one shul in Cape Town, in Claremont Shul, which is a huge shul, has over 1,000 seats, this story took place just prior to Yom Tov, about 12 years ago. So in South Africa, I don't know how it works in Chicago, but in all the big shuls, you still have a person who's called the full-time shamus, or the sexton. His responsibility is to take care of everything that has to do with the shul. He changes the paroiches, the cover of the Aron Kodesh for the different holidays, changes the covers of the Sefer Torah, he puts out the machzorim, sidurim, etc. In Cape Town, he had, for many, many decades, incredible Lithuanian Jews who were the shamashim of all the big shuls. In the Claremont shul, there was a little shamus. It was about this high. Now this wide, he was there for 50 years, beloved to every Jew in Cape Town, called Vasi. Officially Mr. Wasserman, but really known as Vasi. And it's about a week before Slichos, 12 years ago, And the rabbi at the time, Rabbi Lerner, walks into the shul and he sees the following experience take place. Following event take place. And he sees in this particular shul, I'm going to give you football statistics here. The Aron HaKodesh is on the 0-yard line. The Bima, instead of being on the 50-yard line, is actually on the 10-yard line on the other end. And it's a huge shul of over 1,000 seats, cathedral seating. This very, very long, narrow passage in the middle with the Bima all the way on the 10. They have about 20-odd Sifrei Torah. And Mr. Wasserman, Rabbi Lerner sees, opening up the Sefer Torah, opening up the Aron HaKodesh, taking out a Sefer Torah, waddling down with the Sefer Torah, all the way to the Bima on the 10-yard line, walking up the steps, putting it down on the Shulchan, on the table, then standing up on a little step so he can see it. He takes his hands on the two Atzei Chaim, on the two holders, and he starts praying, and he starts crying. And real tears. And this goes on for about 10 minutes. After which he goes around to the front of the Sefer of the Shulchan, takes off the red cover, and puts on the white cover. Holds it again, this time smiling, mumbling something for another few minutes. And he waddles back. And then he takes out the second one. And Rabbi Lerner spends about an hour and a half watching. And at the end of an hour and a half, there are three Sefer Torah ready. And he says, this is ridiculous. Vas is already post 80 years old. At this rate, maybe for Hanukkah, all the Sefer Torah are going to be white. And he runs in the next time Vas is at the Aron HaKodesh, the Holy Ark, and he opens up the Pareches, and he says, Vasi, listen, I'm going to take out each one of the Sefer Torah. You take off the red, put on the white, we'll put it back, we'll be finished in 15 minutes. Vasi looks at him, he says, Rebbe, he says, Avek, out of here. He says, Vasi, I insist. He says, you're not a young man. Some of these Sefer Torah, those old ones, are incredibly heavy. I insist. Vasi bursts out into tears. He says, Rabbi Avek, get out of here. This is my arbit. This is my work. So he says, okay. But just explain to me what you're doing. So he says, Rebbe, he says, I'm the only person in my family who survived. This is in the Haim. At home before the war, my father was a cobbler. He was a very poor man. Once a year, before Yom Tov, either Rosh Hashanah or Pesach, he would buy each one of us something white to wear. Sometimes to the Seder, sometimes to the first night of Rosh Hashanah. The girls got an apron or a pinafore or a blouse. The boys a shirt or a waistcoat. Something white. He says, but I'm the only one left. He opens up the pareches. And he points to the biggest Sefer Torah. He says, Rebbe. He says, Das mein Vater. This big one. It's my father. And the one right next to it, Das mein Mama. And he goes through each one of the Sefer Torah until they come to the smallest one. Das mein kleine Schwester Rachel. That's my little sister Rachel who was killed by the Nazis. And she was 8 years old. He says, Rabbi, I'm getting them ready for Yom Tov. In order to experience freedom, we have to make sure that we address the slavery in our own lives and we eradicate our own limitations of slavery. But we also have to bring to our Seder the legacy of our own families. And remember, the reason the Seder plate silver and the Kiddush cup silver, and there's so much silver on that table, is because the way that we beautify the mitzvah is not just purchasing them, but by consistently polishing them. And making our Seder palatable to everyone who's there, and most importantly to ourselves. If we are not tired, and if we've gone through a process ourselves of addressing the potential imprisonment in our own lives, that we in fact considered the Seder and experienced that transition to freedom, make that bracha of Gal Yisrael, representing the completion of the conversion process, with true joy and a sense of accomplishment, and we can share that with others. Chag Kosher v'Sameach.